Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
All righty, so Prince Harry is heading over to Iraq, and they say he's going to patrol the Iraq-Iran border. Is that a place that's going to get really, really hot in the near future? That's an interesting question. What is going on with Iran? There's so much rhetoric being ramped up around this. And also a number of people out there trying to ramp it down, trying to calm the whole thing down. But there are, you know, we have what, Cy Hirsch a year ago said Bush had already decided he was going to go into Iran. So, by the way, welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. So we thought we'd ask Scott Ritter, the author of Target Iran and Iraq Confidential, one of UNSCOM's most senior weapons inspectors in Iraq between 1991 and 1998, after having served 8 years as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. To come on the program with us. And Scott, you and Jeff Cohen are going to be speaking about war and media in Santa Barbara, California. Today?
Today, yeah.
Yeah, tonight at 7:30. And that's at the Victoria Hall Theater for people in Santa Barbara who might be interested in checking that out. But welcome to the program, Scott.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's always great having you on with us. What's going on here? What's your take on how this thing is all shaking out?
Well, I mean, I think once again it's clear that the Bush administration is hyping up a case for conflict that it can't back up with anything other than rhetoric. It's the same pattern we saw with Iraq, both in terms of the WMD aspect. With Iraq, it was chemical, biological, and nuclear. With Iran, we're told there's this nuclear weapons program that no one's able to provide any evidence to sustain the allegation. And then with Iraq, we were told that Saddam Hussein had these links with Al-Qaeda, the terrorist organization that perpetrated the September 11, 2001 attack. We're being told that the Iranian government today is the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world today, and the best evidence they can trot out are these explosively formed projectiles that date back in terms of use against American troops back to 2003, right when we invaded. But suddenly, it's a hot topic today. It's touted as a new technology, but it's technology I learned back in the Marine Corps when I went to an unconventional warfare class in 1986. It's something that's been around for years.
The IRA was using these things.
The IRA uses them. It's just a standard unconventional warfare tactic.
Yeah. And who, in your opinion, Scott Ritter, is the largest funder of terrorism in the world?
Well, you know, it all depends on whose perspective you're talking about, but I will tell you this. The nation that is responsible for more destabilization in the world today is the United States of America. There's just no doubt about it. We are a nation in search of enemies. Enemies aren't coming to us. Other than September 11th, they came to us. Since that time, they're not coming to us. Iran's not coming at us. Iraq didn't come at us. But we are searching for conflict. We're the nation saying that we get to dictate the terms of coexistence with the rest of the world. We're the nation that's behaving with an imperial agenda and funding others to go in and carry out acts inside sovereign nations such as Iran that if they were perpetrated here in the United States, we would be screaming terrorism.
Yeah. So what are we doing inside Iran right now?
Well, I mean, what is known is that we're collecting intelligence, and we're using a variety of means to do this. There's nothing wrong with collecting intelligence. The problem is, if the methods you use violate the sovereignty of a sovereign state, they often take on warlike actions. For instance, flying an unmanned reconnaissance aircraft over the territory of Iran. Could you imagine if Cuba flew an unmanned reconnaissance aircraft over Florida and was taking photographs of U.S. military installations? We'd shoot that thing out of the sky and scream bloody murder, crying violation of our airspace, warlike act.
Sure.
We're doing that. There are a series of explosions that took place last week that killed a number of Iranian Revolutionary Guards. The Iranians have captured some perpetrators and have produced some physical evidence that seems to tie the attackers to U.S. bases in Pakistan, where it appears that, and Cy Hirsch reported on this a while back, that the CIA and U.S. military special operations are running programs using Baluchi tribesmen to cross into Iran to carry out destabilization acts. They're also using the Mujahideen al-Khalq operating out of Iraqi bases.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what about MEC?
Well, no, I mean, basically the United States has declared war on Iran. It's just not a public declaration. But it is carrying out warlike activities that, you know, the American people may not be aware of, but trust me, the Iranians are fully cognizant of what's going on.
Yeah, and frankly, I think most of the other countries in the region are. This is not a closely held secret. The British press is talking about it even. So here's the question. We're talking with Scott Ritter, author of Target Iran and Iraq Confidential, one of ENSCOM's most senior weapons inspectors in Iraq, 91 to 98. Scott, in your opinion, is this the administration ginning up war rhetoric because they have found it to be very successful to use that in the past to divert attention away from other issues, and there's certainly no end of scandals and issues, you know, from Katrina to the disaster in Iraq to illegally tapping phones. I mean, the list just goes on and on. Is this an attempt to divert our attention for domestic purposes, and they're just going to play it out for a year or so and you know, keep us going on the edge? Or do you think that this is the lead up to an actual attack that they intend to have happen in March or April, I guess, are the dates that I'm hearing most commonly of this year? And if so, if the latter, then what can be done?
Well, I believe that this is the Bush administration executing a policy that it has stated for some time it desires to execute. The Bush administration's stated policy when it comes to the Middle East is regional transformation, and that is inclusive of regime change in nations like Iraq and Iran. People think that Iraq is one policy, Iran is another policy. No, they're the same policy, and the Bush administration is, implementing this policy as we speak. They're dead serious about doing this, and I share the April-June time frame as being a very, very dangerous time. And frankly speaking, what can be done to stop it? Not much. Congress has abrogated its constitutional responsibilities to such an extent by passing two war authorization resolutions, one in September 2001, the other in October 2002, that this president already has, according to many constitutional scholars, all the constitutional authority he needs to wage war. He doesn't need to go to Congress anymore. And he has set up the United Nations to such an extent that they have pretty much given him the green light to hold Iran accountable. Iran today, the deadline passed for Iran to suspend its nuclear enrichment program. If the Security Council does not take stringent action, the United States will have every right to say, wait a minute, you defined this as a problem related to nuclear weapons, and now you're doing nothing? No, the United States will not allow its national security to be hijacked by the international community. We will step in and do something. This is a scenario that's playing out before us. The only way this can be stopped is for Congress to enact something akin to the Boland Amendment. The only power Congress has today to stop this is the power of the purse, to pass a resolution that says no U.S. taxpayer money can be used for covert or overt military or paramilitary action against Iran without the explicit permission of Congress.
Yeah, not a resolution, a law.
If you pass that as a law, now the president can't do anything because he'll go to jail. He'll get impeached.
Right.
But I don't see Congress making that move.
Yeah. Well, there's a few who are talking about it. But, you know, it seems to me that what we really need to be doing is encouraging everybody, all of our listeners, to be contacting their member of Congress and to call the House of Representatives, to call the Senate, you call Capitol Hill, I mean, basically, and just say, to give them their zip code. Every we all have two senators. Each state has two senators. We all have one member of Congress, except for the folks in Washington, D.C. They have a representative as well. Can't vote, but is there and can speak out. And say, we would like a binding law, not a non-binding resolution, a binding law that says that the Bush administration may not use monies previously allocated, money that they may get from, you know, some other source or some, you know, moving it from one budget or to another or something like that, or money that they cannot spend money for the purposes of attacking Iran, period, end of discussion.
That's right. If they do that, the president's hands are tied. Even the president acknowledges that that's the only power Congress has at this point in time. And that's a serious power. You know, and it doesn't tie our hands in Iraq. It doesn't tie our hands in the global war on terror. All it tells the president, it really doesn't tie the president's hand on Iran. All it prevents is a preemptive war. The president now has to go to Congress and make the case. Imagine that.
Right, which is how it's supposed to work.
That's right.
What a surprise. Okay, Scott Ritter, you and Jeff Cohen are going to be in Santa Barbara tonight. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me.
Always great talking with you. Always great talking. 16 minutes past the hour. Boy, how are we going to get out of this one, and how is this going to play out? We'll continue the conversation right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Like a rainbow coalition, a sane voice in the wilderness of war. And we were winning at the centers when we called our representatives, but they pitched the game and lied about the score. Well,
this I know.
Well, this I know. Well, humanity may have never sunk so low. Well, there might be a solution. Let's bring on a revolution, because the royal oligarchy's got to go.
And welcome back. The oligarchy's got to go. Pretty strong language there. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. American Liberty at the Precipice, the title of an editorial in today's New York Times. Is the media waking up? Is the media fast asleep? Is the media going to sell us another war? Is the media taking it seriously? Jeff Cohen, one of the best media analysts I know. He was the producer of Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, nice to be with you.
Of the Donahue program on MSNBC, the author of Cable News Confidential. Your CV is much longer than that. That's all I have written down here. Anything you want to toss in?
Well, you know, I founded the Media Watch Group, FAIR.
That's right. FAIR.org, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Yeah.
Tom, you know, it is the same people that were wrong about Iraq that are now pushing for confrontation with Iran, the same people in the media.
Yeah.
You can go from the ridiculous, like Glenn Beck, who was a talk radio screamer in the run-up to Iraq, just cheerleading for the war, was wrong on every count, and then CNN gives him an hour of prime time on headline news.
Right, and he's been talking about Iran a lot lately.
All he talks about. It's like, you know, they're behind every evil in the world, I guess, except male pattern baldness.
Yeah, well, he'll figure out a way to work that in.
Yeah, and then you have regular experts, so-called, people like Frank Gaffney, who pushed for the Iraq war, was wrong on every count, was on TV show after TV show.
Yeah, I've debated him a couple times on this program.
Yeah, now he's denouncing the appeasers around Iran.
Right.
But the main problem area for me is the New York Times. The role that the Times played with their front page scare stories in the run-up to the Iraq war seems to be happening now. And it's almost like there's been so much criticism of the Times. FAIR has done it, other groups have done it, over their role in the run-up to the Iraq war with Judith Miller and Michael Gordon, but it's happening again. And
Same methodology. Yeah, no, I get it, and I think we're all watching it, many of us with our mouths hanging open. You know, it's like, whoa, I can't believe they're doing it all over again. The question is, well, actually, there's two questions. The first is why. I mean, there's a couple of possible explanations that come to mind, but they're all part of the same group that profits from it. All these big corporations have interlocking boards, and war is a very profitable thing, and to a large extent the U.S. economy is now designed to run on it, to the fact that it sells more newspapers when you have war, to the fact that they want to suck up to the administration. A, and B, what do we do about it? I mean, you know, first of all, what's your take on the why? And then
yeah, the why is always complicated. You've given a factor that may be the minor factor. The structural factor matters, but I can't believe that explains why the New York Times is letting Michael Gordon 11 days ago write a story without named sources about this dubious claim that the most lethal weapons used against U.S. troops in Iraq are being supplied by Iran. It's just
right. Completely
dubious.
But,
I think
but the administration
why,
really pushed that thing hard.
Oh, yeah. It became the hugest story in the news, just like when Michael Gordon and Judith Miller back in September 2002 were pushing their dubious story about Saddam's going aggressively around the world for aluminum tubes and stepping up his nuclear program based on unnamed sources. So I think you might have part of the why, but another part of the why is this is the way mainstream journalism has been deformed over a period of decades, where you go to these intelligence sources, no one is held accountable. Even if they were wrong in pushing for Iraq, they're still your sources. These intelligence officers, retired intelligence officers, think tank people that used to be intelligence officers. And, you know, if you counted that story of 12 days ago, this one that about lethal weapons in Iraq coming from Iran, there were 25 sourced assertions, and 24 of them were unnamed. And, you know, so to me...
So how do we hold the media accountable?
Yeah, people should be lining up with Fair.org and Media Matters, because, they're, you know, when I heard you and Scott correctly say, contact your two senators, contact your representative, and make them pass something akin to a Boland Amendment to deny any money to a preemptive war in Iran. People need to contact the New York Times and ask Michael Gordon, who with Judith Miller was so wrong with unnamed sources in the run-up to Iraq, why isn't there some quality control? You know, when he writes a story with 24 unnamed sources out of 25,
yeah.
U.S. intelligence...
But, you know, at the same time, the Times, I mean, for example, their editorial today about the Military Commissions Act basically asking, you know, saying this thing should be repealed. I mean,
There's always some good editorial.
The Times does some really good stuff. I just don't get it. Why they're going off the rails here?
Well, you're right. There's often good editorials. There's certainly great op-ed columnists.
And there's some very good reporting in the New York Times.
Yeah, and there's some good, but their quote national security reporting always has these same flaws. No one is held accountable. Michael Gordon was not held accountable 4 years ago. He's not the kind of guy you can count on to hold the Bush administration accountable. This guy has been writing stories in the New York Times about how we can't even discuss withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq. Then he goes on programs like Charlie Rose, and he becomes an advocate pushing Bush's surge. There's no pretense of objectivity. He shouldn't be on the front page of the New York Times, and readers of the Times should contact that paper and say, why is Michael Gordon being allowed to use the same methods that helped push us into the last foreign policy disaster in Iraq?
Yep. Okay, got it. Jeff Cohen, Fair.org. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
It is so true. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. I just want to share with you a very short campaign. It's actually a montage of this is from a single campaign speech in 1968. This is Richard Nixon before the Republican National Convention, where he was nominated to run for president in 68. This is basically the platform that he ran on against LBJ, who was not, you know, running any longer, but basically he ran on the past. And it might offer some lessons for Democrats in the future, because, you know, he was ultimately successful with this. As I said, this is a montage. You'll notice there's 3 points in here where we've just kind of clipped one into the other. But here, Richard Nixon, listen carefully to what Nixon had to say.
For 4 years, this administration has had the support of the loyal opposition for the objective of seeking an honorable end to the struggle. Never has so much military and economic and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively. And if after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership, not tied to the mistakes and the policies of the past. That is what we offer to America. Look at our problems abroad. Do you realize that we face the stark truth that we are worse off in every area of the world tonight than we were. We've had enough of big promises and little action. The time has come for honest government in the United States of America. And there is only one answer to such a record of failure, and that is a complete house cleaning of those responsible for the failures on that record.
So ironic. It's Richard Nixon. And yet, I mean, what Vietnam did to us is so identical to what Iraq is doing to us, although I would argue that Iraq is doing it to us in a much more dangerous way. Vietnam was not one of the most inflammable places on earth. We've created a situation now where it's like, you know, two guys standing in a room in, filled with gasoline up to their ankles, each one holding a book of matches in his hand. And, I mean, that's what we're down to. I mean, this is pretty grim stuff. Our quote for the day, by the way, from Teddy Roosevelt, patriotism means to stand by the country. It does not mean to stand by the president. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Toll-free nationwide, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi, it's right up at the top of the page, and say hello. Dave in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to just second what the last guest said.
Yeah, Jeff Cohen.
He was talking about how the difference between the Times editorial policy and their reporting, because, you know, they do have some good, really good columnists, and they write some sensible editorials, but they really haven't distinguished themselves in the last few years. I mean, they do have some good reporters, but... I mean, particularly about Iraq, you know, Knight Ritter was way ahead of them. And lately, you know, there have been a lot of good reporting in the Washington Post. But, yeah, I think the thing that distinguishes them, if anything, is some of their columnists and their editorial. But the reporting has, you know, the fact that Michael Gordon is still on this beat writing these stories says a lot about, even after all this turnover, you know, there is no quality control.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear his side of that. And, you know, maybe we can track that down, But I think that one of the things that we all have to do with all of our media, whether it's the New York Times or whether it's local media, you know, in my case out in Oregon, the Oregonian, is, you know, let them know when you're not happy with the way that they're covering issues, or particularly if you think that they're swallowing a line that's being fed to them, you know, hook, line, and sinker that they really shouldn't be taking. You know, it's just let them know. They all have a means to do that, and frankly, the media is probably much more responsive, much more reactive and responsive than most people think. Not probably, I know they are. They do listen to their readers and to their listeners and to their viewers, as it were. And so, you know, make your voice heard. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say I don't trust the journalism of the New York Times much anymore. The editorial page is usually on the mark. And surprisingly, I find reporting in the Wall Street Journal to often be more objective than that in the New York Times, and it's really weird.
I quote from the New York from the Wall Street Journal an awful lot on this program because, you know, they broke the story back, what, 2 years ago? I think we did a whole thing on this show, a series that they did on the rationing of health care in the United States, and they just came out and called it that. They broke the story of William McGuire making $1.78 billion as the head of the second largest health care company in America. You know, not providing any health to care to anybody, just moving dollars around. They've broken a number of stories, some very, very good investigative and solid reporting being done by the Wall Street Journal, although their editorial page is so whacked out to the right that it's like, you know, I lack adjectives.
Yeah, I took their editorial section for the Republicans' newest talking point.
Well, that's where you'll find them. That's where you'll find them. Yeah, it's the beginning. In fact, it's very often the very beginning of the right-wing echo chamber. Karen, thank you very much for the call and for the point. Cheryl in Illinois. Hey, Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hello, Mr. Hartman.
Tom, please.
Tom, I just spent 45 minutes on the phone, and I'm extremely upset. It's concerning the posse comitatus.
Yes.
I have called my senators, Durbin and Obama's office.
Mm-hmm.
I was transferred around and around. Not one person I spoke to knew what posse comitatus was.
Well, for our listeners,
thought it was a group.
Right. For our listeners who don't know, and that's one of the problems, is that here we are using what I'm assuming is Latin. The Posse Comitatus Act came after the Civil War, where we said basically we will never again have the U.S. Army firing on U.S. citizens within the boundaries of the United States of America. And it's illegal for the Army to be engaged in functions that most correctly should be done by the police. And it just can't be done. And this just got reversed in October, just a few months ago, by the Military Commissions Act, by the a rider that I don't think most people in Congress even realized they were signing, that was attached to a piece of language that was attached to the appropriation, the Defense Appropriation Bill, the John Warner Defense Appropriation Bill of 2006.
Okay, that's what I wasn't clear on, what it was attached to.
Yeah, it was attached to the Defense Appropriations Bill, and it essentially did away with posse comitatus. And then also, there's, you know, Bush issued an executive order last week that went even farther on this. And so, you know, you've got both of these issues. We need to be very seriously looking at this.
Well, the way I understand it, none of the governors were even consulted on this, and a major issue in this is that it takes the power of our governors, our individual governors, our states, takes their power away from
right.
them.
That's the executive order that Bush signed last week. Was
okay.
You know, to federalize the National Guard. That was about federalizing
that.
The National Guard, which is also would be a violation of posse comitatus if it hadn't been stripped out back in October.
Right. Yeah. Well, I even called Blagojevich's office, and no one in there knew anything about it either. Yet I understood that all now granted, I didn't get to talk to the governor himself. I talked to staffers
sure.
in the legislative department. But I'm very concerned that people that are hands-on right there don't even know about it. So how are we, people like us that listen, close our ears to the mass-produced media that listen to the truth?
Well, we inform them. I mean, what you did, Cheryl, in calling the offices of Senators Obama and who was the other senator you called? Oh, Dick Durbin. Yeah, you're from Illinois.
Durbin,
yeah, clearly.
And Blagojevich.
Yeah, but what you did by calling those offices and talking to all those staffers, I'm hoping and assuming that you informed them what posse comitatus means.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you know, that's incredibly important. That's it, particularly if they don't know what it means.
It's incredibly staggering to me that they don't know about it. I mean,
yeah.
Here's the thing that gets me, too. We elect these officials to protect our interests, and they're up there signing bills that they're not even reading.
Yeah.
You know, if you make a bill so doggone thick that you can't read it, then there's got to be a problem. And
right.
I also told them, I wanted the name of the person responsible or persons responsible for slipping that in back in October. Responsibility needs to be taken.
Yeah,
I'm tired of no responsibility being taken for what's being done to us.
Right, for the loss of our liberties. Cheryl, spot on. Spot on, and I honor you and congratulate you and thank you for being an activist, for calling
the
your
people. They need to stand up. They've got to quit taking this land down or just ignoring it because they're tired of it. Well, you know, our soldiers are tired.
Mm-hmm.
Our soldiers are tired, and I think the American people need to get off their bum and wake up to see what's going on around them. It's just so frustrating.
Yeah.
In the area that I live in, well, you know, the local gossip is more important than what's happening in our country.
But you're doing it exactly right, Cheryl, is taking those emotions, say whether it's frustration or anger or fear or whatever it may be, taking all those negative emotions and rechanneling them as activism, as making those calls. And you did brilliantly, and I thank you so much for it.
I wish I could do more.
Keep it up. I mean, call them once a week and write letters to the editor of the local newspaper and keep calling talk radio, this program, and any other programs, and keep the word out. God bless you. You're doing great work. Cheryl, thanks so much for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio. Yes, it's supported by you, our listeners, listening very carefully to your local station for your local sponsors and patronizing their products. Let them know that you're listening. Give them a call. Send your friends over if you can't, if you're not interested specifically in buying their products, because it's our local sponsors and our local affiliates that really keep programs like this going and keep this format going, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, all organic, all fair trade, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, latest iPods at smalldog.com, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, or ecowine.com. So, 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. This Franklin Roosevelt, you know, I played that clip from Richard Nixon. It's just, you know, dead President's Day, okay? Just, here's another one. This is a very, very short one. Franklin Roosevelt. Again, how far we have come from the ideals that we used to hold.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
So, you know, somebody should, like, play that to George Bush on a speaker under his pillow every night. By the way, Nancy Pelosi, what a great comeback. Cheney comes out and, you know, Blair is pulling some of his troops out of Iraq. So Cheney comes out and says, proves that we're being successful. So Pelosi says, I think if we were to do what Speaker Pelosi, Cheney says, I think if we were to do what Speaker Pelosi and Congressman Murtha are suggesting, all we'll do is validate the Al-Qaeda strategy. Right? I mean, this is outrageous. In fact, she called President Bush to protest. Her official response, Vice President Cheney continues to question the patriotism of those of us in Congress who challenged the Bush administration's misguided policies in Iraq, and his latest attack is beneath the office of the vice president, especially at a time of war. And then, you know, on another occasion, she made the point that, you know, well, if it's a success that we're Great Britain is pulling troops out, then why don't we start pulling troops out and share that success? Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank.
Yes.
What's up?
Hi. I'm 57 years old, and for the first time in life, I'm beginning to think I'm a paranoid wacko or something. I'd like to address this. I watch a president and a vice president who preach their imperial presidency, got the Constitution, and do their signing orders, and wipe out posse comitatus and so forth. I'm beginning to honestly worry whether or not, if there were another terrorist attack, or just the Iran war, whether these people really would love to declare martial law and just do away with the next election. I know that sounds wacko, but...
Yeah, well, you've got Bush, you know, with his famous saying, if this were a dictatorship, it would be a whole heck of a lot easier, so just as long as I'm a dictator. I think that was somewhat revealing. If their intention is to instate martial law, they are certainly putting into place all the pieces necessary to do that. And I think we should all be genuinely concerned about that.
I know we have a military that probably would not allow that. That's the one thing we have going in this country that a lot of the country.
And we have the people who will not allow that. I mean, this is the difference between us and Germany. Germany had about a 10 or 15 year experience with democracy when Hitler came along.
Well, you know, we have for
200 years.
When I realized the news media is spending 20 times more time on Britney Spears and Nicole Smith than they are on the war in Iraq, I begin to wonder.
Yeah, well, you know, it depends on how you define the news media. But, yeah, I get your concern, and I share it, Frank. And I don't think that we should become freaked out by this. I think we just need to be very careful, very thorough, very straightforward, and just say, you know, this will not stand. We're going to take the steps necessary by contacting our elected representatives, contacting the media, holding the media accountable, holding our elected representatives accountable, and say, hey, we're the parade. We're heading down the street here. Get on board with us. Get out in front of the parade and hoist a flag. Become part of it. We want to take America back to the core values on which this country was founded. Tim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, Jim. What's up?
It was what Frank said there is basically the same thing that I've been thinking about. And, you know, he was saying that, you know, he doesn't think the military will do it. But, you know, the thing is with the posse comitatus thing, you know, he's put everything in place to do this, and it's scary. I mean, like on 9/11, initially I thought, well, it was just it's just negligence, you know, that caused this to happen or allowed it to happen. But the more I read, the more I kind of wonder if they put this thing together and the whole 9/11 thing. And if they did that again, they've just put so much in place.
Yeah.
To declare martial law. Not only that, but they've basically built a 100,000 strong mercenary army in Iraq with
right,
all these,
right. And a whole lot more here in the United States.
And what do we, you know, the guys, you know, Frank was saying, well, we have the military on our side, but you see what I'm saying? It's just
I do, and I, you know, as I said, I am concerned about this too, Jim, and there are many members. I, you know, frankly, Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, is concerned about this, and essentially, you know, in his confrontation with Gonzalez, was raising many of these same issues. I think that I frankly don't believe that if Bush was to try to declare military law, that he could get away with it. It wouldn't surprise me if he tried. I mean, I'm not expecting it, but it wouldn't surprise me if he tried, but I don't think that he'd be able to get away with it, even though he has put all the pieces in place for it.
What would stop him? What would stop him?
I think that the military would stop him. I think that Congress would stop him. I think it would precipitate, you know, last Friday we had Bernie Sanders on, and we were talking, he's on the program every Friday, and he said,
yeah,
you know, if Bush was to do something like this, it would precipitate a constitutional crisis. And I said, you know, is that code for impeachment? And he was like, essentially, yes. You know, that's the, you know, Congress would immediately stand up and say, no, this will not stand, and Republicans would be joining Democrats in it. And I believe he's right. I really do.
Yeah,
so,
but what if they, you know, grab all the congressmen and put them in prison? I mean,
yeah,
I just
can't imagine. Maybe I'm being naive, but I just can't imagine that happening in the United States. It's we have been through so much. I mean, from the Civil War on, I mean, we have been through so much. We democracy is in our genes in this country. We do need to take back these powers. We absolutely need to take back these powers. But I don't, you know, I don't think that it's going to stand. We have to prevent the possibility of it. I absolutely agree with you. But let's not, you know, let's not let this get beyond our ability to deal with it emotionally. You know, let's be very dispassionate about it and contact our elected officials, as our caller did in the last quarter hour, and say, you know, hey, let me tell you about Posse Comitatus.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Does intent have anything to do with whether or not a crime has been committed? Or should it have, should intent have something to do with how we deal with behavior that may or may not be criminal, whether or not something should be criminal? Christopher J. Klicka is with us. He's senior counsel to the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, hslda.org, the website. And Chris, you wanted to talk about stophatecrimesnow.com and the hate, asking the question, does hate crime legislation go too far, if you have this right?
Oh, definitely. There is so much abuse of hate crime legislation where pretty soon people can't talk about virtually anything or take a stand or position.
Yeah, so
very
dangerous. So we have here a grandmother over at this website, StopHateCrimesNow.com, talking about how she got basically busted for what, in her opinion, was, you know, simply speaking her mind and you know, going out and exercising her First Amendment rights. Here she is.
Oh, and
but now we know better. My
the European nationality
has proven my 75-year-old grandmother is three. On October 10, 2004, I attended a homosexual event in Philadelphia. We went there to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, but instead I was arrested, jailed, and charged under Pennsylvania hate crimes law.
Now, you know, I'm looking at the flyer here, and it says that she was passing out. And thank God for the tsunami and the 2,000 dead Swedes. I mean, the story, the article on this is that actually she was arrested for using a bullhorn and shouting down people. I mean, this, It's a little different than just exercising your First Amendment rights. And why should, and basically I think what you guys are arguing against is that homosexuality, that being gay, should be included as a protected category when it comes to hate crimes.
Oh, and that's what's the driving force behind it. There's no doubt about it. A lot of countries, European countries that have passed hate crimes legislation, it's almost all targeted to protect the homosexual lifestyle. And any pastor that takes a stand, or even in Netherlands, a pastor was just preaching on the Bible and was quoting the scripture, and now he's facing charges.
Yeah, but this is not the Netherlands, and nobody is proposing that kind of law. What we're suggesting here in the United States, this adding sexual orientation to hate crime legislation, is that if you're hurting somebody or if you kill somebody and you can show that there was malicious intent associated with it that had to do with, you know, hating them because they were gay, that makes the crime all the worse. We have these clear definitions of murder. I mean, for murder in the first degree with premeditation, murder in the second degree without, manslaughter, you know, accidental murder. They all have to do with intent. What's wrong with attaching intent to other types of crimes? Or is it just that you think that it should be fine to commit crimes against gay people and there not be any additional penalty beyond that for the crime itself?
Yeah, I don't believe there should be any additional penalty, because a crime is a crime. Murder is murder. You know, beating somebody up is beating somebody up.
So you think if somebody's motivated by racism, for example, that should not be considered by the jury in condemning their behavior?
You know, personally, I don't think so. I think that if the crime was committed, obviously, if the you know, the way they killed the person or they made them suffer and that sort of thing, all should be taken into account.
Well, let's take something that's not quite that severe. You've got somebody who, for example, is burning a cross on the lawn of a black family. Now, burning a cross is not a huge crime, in all probability. I mean, you know, it's maybe vandalism or something. It might be a small crime, in fact. I'm not an attorney or a police officer. I don't know the details, but it's not, you know, a big deal. Except that if it's being done in the lawn of a black family, it's there's clearly a secondary agenda there. And I mean, you know, we saw this in Germany with the stickers in the store windows in the early 30s. About Jewish stores that had Jewish ownership had to have the Star of David in their window, and others had signs that said no Jews here and stuff like that. I mean, this kind of speech, and I'll agree with you that it's speech, this kind of speech can lead to the kinds of violence that can lead to the kind of situation like we had in Germany, or they had in Germany. It seems to me just common sense to say that somebody's intent should be considered.
And you may be right on that. It's something, you know, juries should weigh in the process of it. But you just got to be so careful that you don't create this kind of legislation, because it's a slippery slope. And all I can do is point to Europe and how far they've gone.
But again, we're not Europe. And you know, you're an attorney. You're the senior counsel for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. I've got nothing against homeschooling. In fact, we homeschooled one of our kids, although I'm assuming that you're more with the Christian homeschool movement than the secular homeschool movement. But nonetheless, this whole issue of trying to prevent gays from being protected under hate crime legislation, gays and lesbians from being protected under hate crime legislation, the same way that African Americans are protected under hate crime legislation or other minority groups, seems to me there's something missing here. Is it because you think that people who are gay should not have the same kinds of civil rights or protections that other minorities in the United States, that we as a society have collectively agreed other minorities should have, when there are people in the majority who have a tendency to try to harm them? I mean, there's a long history of harm.
Well, it's kind of crazy when you think about including gays as minority, when, you know, all it is they're choosing a lifestyle of having sexual relations in the rear ends of other men.
They're not choosing a lifestyle. I don't know anybody who did not know by the time they were a child, but you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, whether they found themselves attracted to men or women. You know, I, as a straight man, I knew that I was straight as a child. I have gay friends who knew that they were gay as kids. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't buy it that this is a choice that people make.
Well,
neither do most biologists. I mean, you look at the animal kingdom, you see, you know, about 10% of most mammals are gay. And here we are in the human race, and it seems like maybe about 10% of us are gay.
Yeah, it's you know, the science, I think, is actually the opposite. It shows that it is a lifestyle that somebody chooses, and it's not.
So
I mean,
those gay sheep out there that they're doing the research on at the University of Oregon, I think it is, they're just choosing to be gay?
Well, you have people that have tendency towards stealing, tendency towards, you know, beating people up, tendency towards anger, tendency, but they all have to deal with it. They have to, you know, gain self-control, and, you know, otherwise they're going to get in trouble. And, you know, it's the same with the gay lifestyle.
So you think it should be against the law to
have
be gay?
Have self-control.
You think it should be against the law to act out any sort of gay behavior?
Well, the first 150 years in our country it was. And, you know,
and look at all the lives that were destroyed by that.
Well, I think of the sanctity of marriage, the importance of family. Without family, we're going to have our nation's going to go the way of these European nations that are just, you know, in shambles. And they have so many
problems.
They're
in shambles because they have good social safety nets and decent paying jobs and strong unions and national health care.
It's because their families,
what am I missing here?
Are broken down. The families.
The main driver.
The family unit is between a man and a woman. That's the way God ordained it. That's the way it should be. And that's the way, you know, God says that it's an abomination for a man to lust after another man. And that's, you know, that's something that our country was based on, the Christian foundation, on biblical principles.
Christopher Klicka, if you want to save marriages in the United States, first of all, the main driver for divorce in the United States is economic. It's this 26-year war ever since Reagan came into office on the middle class that's ripping the middle class apart. That's the main cause for divorce, number one. It's not infidelity or anything else. It's economic problems cause conflict in relationships. And two, why don't you make divorce illegal? I mean, if you're so gung-ho about, you know, we've got to have heterosexual couples.
Well, you know,
do you want to do that? I mean, that used to be the law in Ireland, for example.
We very much support the marriage amendments, and we think that is an institution that should be preserved. Marriage should only be between a man and a woman, not between two men or two women.
But there's a lot of good gay people out there who could provide families, and there's a lot of kids who need families. I mean, you know, why?
Because God said.
God said. Okay.
Got to obey him.
All righty. Christopher Klicka, his website, hslda.org. Christopher, thanks for coming on the program and talking with us today.
Okay. God bless you.
And God bless you too, sir. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Something
wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A place where smart people get their news. I'll tell you, the issue here, ultimately for me, at the bottom line, the issue is hate. I am frankly very concerned. You know, obviously there's a subtext or, you know, the issue of, you know, in my opinion, gays should be allowed to marry and raise kids. And I mean, welcome to the human family. This is a civil rights issue. We've gone through a whole series of these. We used to exclude African Americans, and then and women, and we've been bringing, speaking as a white male, right? But we as Americans, We have been bringing everybody into the family. Let's bring the rest of us in. But it even goes beyond that. One of the things that where it goes is this whole idea of whipping up hate. I mean, this grandmother who was, you know, in the audio clip that this guy is promoting on that website about stophatecrimes.com, she says, Philadelphia views the biblical message of sin and repentance as hate speech. Following said that while some question his client's wisdom in loudly proclaiming the gospel at a gay festival, they had a constitutional right to do so and shouldn't be punished for it. The four members of Repent America are charged with ethnic intimidation, criminal conspiracy, and inciting to riot. Video of the event shows them marching to the front of a stage at Outfest and yelling biblical passages to drown out the events on stage. Police attempted to get the protesters to move to an area on the edge of the site. Instead, they went deeper into the gay crowd. Using a bullhorn, they condemned homosexuality. They then got into an argument with a group of pink angels who screamed back. At that point, the police intervened.
But I'm just a grandmother.
That's what, you know, on the website, right? And then you've got radio talk show hosts who are out there promoting hate just as well.
I understand that it's confusing sometimes what we do and why we're there, but even your
adversaries, Diane Sawyer,
have their own point of view, and how can you tackle this part of the world if you don't understand why they say they're doing
more.
What they're doing?
Now let me just set this up. That was what you were hearing was Michael's. It was Diane Sawyer. Now, I'm doing an interview, and that "you lying whore" that you just heard underneath it was Michael Wiener, Michael Savage. And he continues.
Even
you lying whore.
Teach you something about why they are doing what
you
they're doing.
Lying
and
whore, you lying whore.
Trying to bring back real information in this critical time for these people who live in that part of the world. It is so complicated.
You're full of crap. Who do you think you're fooling? You're a liar. And the reason you gave this interview about that interview is because you realize what you have done. You're being told that the people hate your guts. I don't know how this goes on in this country. That a witch, a whore like Diane Sawyer, and I'm going to stick to those words. To me, she's a whore. She's a whore for selling out her intellect like this.
You get what kind of language, what kind of, how, the, you know, let's whip up the people? I mean, there's something, frankly, I think very tragic about this. About Michael Savage going on in these kind of hateful way. I mean, this is
boring herself for ratings. She goes and visits the Hitler of our time, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, does not challenge him on one of his statements, not one. And she does it just for ratings. And she has the nerve to come back here and pretend that it's confusing on what we do and why we're there. Who do you think you're talking to?
Yeah. So, and this is, it's time for civil discourse in America. I really, 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 truly believe it is time for civil discourse in America. We have enough hate. Thank you very much. There is enough going on. It is time to speak out and say, you know, there is actually a positive force in the world. John Kennedy talked about it, for example, on June 10th, 1963.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds, and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace.
Peace. And he's not talking about the peace of the grave.
What peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children, not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
And you get it? If a politician today was to get up and give a speech like that, and to talk about peace as a positive value. If a politician today gets up and speaks about tolerance as a positive value. If a politician today speaks out and says, you know, let's bring everybody into the family of humanity. Let's live together cooperatively. They say, you are some kind of utopian crazy. No. This peace, in my opinion, is the natural state of human beings. It is. Peace and democracy are built into us. In fact, when we come back from the break, I'm going to tell you a story about Red Deer and DNA, and then I'll be taking your phone calls. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The True People's Radio. We'll be right back. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Except for the drilling in the wall. The curtain had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance! 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Free hangout with some of the finest minds in the entire universe. It's a hoot, live chat. And I hang out there during the breaks. It's a little more difficult this week doing the show from New York because there's just like so much going on here. But when I get back in Portland, I'll be far more interactive. And in fact, broadcasting live today from the studios of Air America all this week here in New York City. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, and Richard in New York City. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. I've got to tell you that I'm not real familiar with you, but I've been listening this afternoon, and you're so respectful and pleasant with your callers that it compelled me to give a call and offer a kind of a opposing Christian viewpoint with regard to same gender unions.
Sure.
Marriage. I consider myself a devout Christian. And my wife and I were married under the care of our church. And we have a marriage certificate from the church, which we value and cherish. And it hangs on our bedroom wall. It's been hanging there for over 20 years now. We lost our state marriage license. We really didn't care too much about it until we had to prove our marriage to qualify for employer-sponsored health insurance. We had to send away to Virginia to get a copy. It just makes sense to us that if folks cherish their views about God and what God intended, let them be married in their churches and cherish the vows that they take in that church.
But let everybody else have civil unions. Is that your point? Is that where you're going with that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why not?
Here's the problem with civil unions. I used to take that position. I lived in Vermont when Vermont got civil unions, and I remember going down when the legislature was debating it, and when Howard Dean signed the law, and the Baptist Church from Kansas was out there with their "Gods Hate Fags" signs. By the way, it's a typo. They are misquoting the Bible. There's no place in the Bible where it says God hates fags, but there's three places in the Bible where it explicitly says God hates figs. He cursed the fig tree. Jesus did twice, and there's a place in Isaiah where a fig tree is cursed, so it's actually God hates figs. In fact, there's a website about that, GodHatesFigs.com, about the biblical basis of it. But the point is that when civil unions were passed, this is really great. And then we discovered that there's some problems with civil unions, and that is that there are all these laws that use the word marriage. And if they didn't, I mean, you're right. There are these two separate institutions. And speaking myself as somebody who is Christian, who was married in a church, and who has been married for 35 years this November, there is a religious component to it, and there is a legal component to it. The problem is that if we try to split out and say, okay, gay people get to get married, but we're not going to call it marriage. We're going to call it civil unions. There's literally thousands of laws in the books in various states and at the federal level that use the word marriage that are going to exclude those people. And this is one of the challenges that folks are having when they engage in civil unions. I just think that we should use the phrase, legal marriage and religious marriage. I mean, if you want it, the Catholic Church has different rules about marriage. And for example, I mean, once you're married, you can't get divorced. You have to go through the whole annulment thing. I mean, it's just every institution I've lived and worked in countries where you can marry multiple people. I mean, these are things that enough said. I think I made my point. David in Blaine, thanks for the call, by the way. David in Blaine, Washington, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know, about peace, you were speaking about before the break. The ultimate reality the Constitution of the United States of America embraces, and the seeds of higher consciousness that were planted during that time, not only describes a peaceful world, but a future galactic star nation. And various tribes around the planet speak of this, and we're totally living in that time period right now. We are totally in the slot. And so when all the smoke dissipates, all the people of this planet will begin to see clearly that these warmongering, these fear-mongering regimes all over the planet that want to keep people confused and separated and divided and not able to connect the dots, they're wrong.
And we're all going to get it. David, I hope and pray you're right. Here, let me just give you another little piece of Jack Kennedy on this.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
Amen. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude.
Hey, Tom, I wish you well.
Thank you.
I wanted just to make two comments. The lady that called earlier that was so outraged over the, posse comitatus.
Yes.
Really reminded me of when you would read about Jesus in the temple and how he was so outraged over the money traders and all of that. But I'm calling mainly because of an article that I read.
It's called Righteous Indignation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's like, I've had enough.
Yeah.
In Harper's December 2006, they have an article called Through a Glass Darkly. Mm-hmm. And it gets into the whole, Christian right regaining, redefining U.S. history.
Yes.
And it gets into Rush Dooney being the father of homeschooling and all of that.
Yeah, I've read it.
But what
and
bothered
it talks
me,
about the Dominionist movement.
The Dominionists, yes. But what really bothered me was the young man, the attorney, when we start getting into legality, the segue went over to Carol Lamb, that U.S. attorney.
Mm-hmm.
2 days before she had to step down from her position, she obtained convictions on that third highest member in the CIA, Fago,
mm-hmm.
and the contractor, Wilkes.
Right, who had been the ones corrupting, for those listeners who aren't familiar, had been the ones corrupting, or maybe that's not the right word, but whatever, Duke Cunningham.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it goes in, there's so many ties. And, Tom, please look into the Correction Corporation of America that we talked last week, the private prisons for profit.
Okay, will do. Thanks
thank
a lot,
you,
Jude. Appreciate it. And let one more quick JFK, I'm trying to intersperse JFK clips with calls here. This is so important.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
And then he went on to say,
our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility. For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute.
Well, that was all before John Bolton and George Bush. Clarissa in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Clarissa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for my call. First-time caller.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Just plain or not, we're discussing this comment, but she wasn't sure if you had already made a comment towards it or not, but just in case, I still wanted to find out. If, with all the impeachment talk that we can't do this and we can't do that and everything is being dragged and pushed to the side, is it possible for us to, for the families who lost loved ones, precious loved ones in Iraq. Can they sue the entire Bush administration for wrongful death in a class action suit?
That's a good question, Clarissa. I'm not an attorney, and I don't know the answer. I do know that it is very, very difficult to sue the federal government. There is a doctrine at law that suggests that basically in order to sue the federal government, you have to have the permission of the government.
Oh, and, my gosh.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, what the boundaries of that are. I don't know where it begins and ends. And also, military families, I mean, when somebody joins the military, they essentially sign a contract that says that they acknowledge that they are, A, going to follow orders, and, B, that uh-huh. following those orders may cause them to lose their lives. So I'm not sure that there would be a basis for a class action suit. You know, that would have to do with something like breach of contract or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I do think that military families, however, organizing and speaking out against this war is like just a really good and healthy thing, and pushing our elected officials to investigate whether lies were told, whether we were lied into a war, and whether that's a criminal breach of George Bush's oath of office.
Exactly, and I was even thinking, if we can't go politically, then maybe the families can go another roundabout way and go into attacking the ones in CIA or FBI, whoever put the intelligence reports together that contained lies to get to that point.
Yeah, that was Doug Feith and his friends. That was Doug Feith and Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl and the Rumsfeld. I mean, that was the bunch. They created this sort of Office of Special Plans inside the Pentagon. They were stovepiping the intelligence. They were grabbing raw CIA stuff, putting their own spin on it rather than having it being analyzed by CIA analysts and thoroughly, considered, and then handing it off to Cheney so that he could hand it off to Bush and say, here, put this in your speech. Here's what you need to know. Yeah, so it's pretty grim stuff, Clarissa. And
it needs to be stopped.
I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the stuff. Those are the kind of investigations, and that's the kind of information that needs to be coming out in a context that could be provided, that could be used for some sort of a prosecution, even if that prosecution is called impeachment, in my opinion. Although, I doubt it would get to that, but I think it would be a fine thing. At the very least, even without success, it would say to the rest of the world, We don't stand for this.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. One last clip from John Kennedy here, pulling it together. The whole idea of peace and the being the antithesis of hate and intolerance.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
There you go. War and hate and oppression. Nancy in San Francisco, California. Hey, Nancy, welcome.
Hi. I think you're one of the most intelligent people I've ever listened to.
Well, thank you. I think.
And I was very ill in bed most of the time for 2 years, and that's how I became acquainted with your show.
Uh-huh.
And it was so entertaining, and I have learned so much. I can't believe how bright you are.
Well, thank you, Nancy. That's not what you called about, though, I'm guessing.
No, what I called about is I was born in San Jose, known as Silicon Valley now,
mm-hmm.
and born and raised there till later years, came up to Northern California, Petaluma, which is just 40 miles north of San Francisco. So I've been in the Bay Area all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up never hearing anything about homosexuality anything, nothing, whatever. Mm-hmm. I married for 17 years to a wonderful man. But all of a sudden, one day, overnight, I went into clinical depression. Saw a psychiatrist. He tells me about homosexuality. Well, I didn't believe this. So I put myself at Stanford University Hospital in Palo Alto. Was there a whole week, healthy as hell, nothing wrong with me, but I still had clinical depression. I still couldn't do dishes, a lot of other things. Anyway, went back to my psychiatrist, started to look into this, and my husband and I separated and divorced. And my life has lived as a gay woman ever since, and I'm 79 now.
Uh-huh.
So, what brings me...
So,
what
do you think that you were always gay and
Oh, yes, I always was.
And your marriage was just kind of...
It was okay. I did my duty, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Okay? And I hated every minute of it.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I didn't know why, and yet I fell in love with a woman while I was married.
Yeah.
With an ex-school friend.
Yeah.
And anyway, I tried to take my life off the Golden Gate Bridge because I hit such a low.
Ouch.
And I talked to Woolsey when she comes into our area, our Congresswoman Woolsey.
Right.
And give her things on this and stuff, because one of the things I discussed with her, plus other things. And I wish these religious people mind their own damn business, personally.
Yeah, that's ultimately what it comes down to, Nancy.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you, and I thank you for the call and for the point that you made, because you made it very well. Michael in Bailey, Colorado. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Boy, I have to almost agree with that last lady about minding their own business.
Yeah. It's really, you know, what happens in our bedroom should be what happens in our bedroom. Consenting adults. It's just, you know, period.
Not only that, but these are people who, you know, they get on all these different talk shows and they espouse all this Christianity, but then when you listen to what they're talking, it's all hatred.
Yeah.
They aren't talking about forgiving their brothers, talking with people who have a different viewpoint and winning them over, possibly. They are absolutely talking hatred.
Yeah.
And then you get an idiot like Bush who gets up and runs on a campaign originally about how he was a reborn Christian and he's the best candidate because of his morals, but here we
and
have
then he
Iran
leads to the death of 600,000 people. I mean, you know, it's...
You know, and this is a platform, this is one of the biggest, openest platforms for getting your point out, being the president. I mean, come on, everybody does a press conference with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, here you have something boiling in Iran because of rhetoric that another leader is talking, and you got this fool who's talking about, well, we don't talk to our enemies.
Yeah, I
but
know.
We'll send another man over there to be tortured by the same people.
Yeah, in fact, we send people to Syria to be tortured. Good point, Michael. And the hypocrisy just seems to never end, and that's why it's time to call it out, frankly. Craig in San Jose. Hey, Craig.
Oh, hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, I think the tragedy with Christianity and homosexuality is that the Bible doesn't condemn homosexuality. If you look at the 8 or 9 passages that are most often quoted from the Bible as proving that the Bible condemns homosexuality, and you look at them as biblical scholars have done over the last 30 or 40 years in the proper cultural context, and taking into account very subtle nuances of word meanings and so on and so forth, you find that the Bible does not condemn homosexuality.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, there are 600 and some odd specific rules. I mean, this is not one of the Ten Commandments, and this is certainly nothing that Jesus ever preached. So, you know, whether you're looking at Judaism or Christianity, and there are 600 and some odd rules back there in Deuteronomy. I mean, you can't wear fabric made out of two different kinds of clothing. You can't eat shellfish. You can't, I mean, it just goes on and on.
Leviticus says, you know, that their parents should be stoned to death.
Right,
and
yeah,
just,
well,
nuts.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, you know, just basically these guys are very, very selectively quoting the Bible in order to justify their own paranoia, Craig, and their own, frankly, you know, hatred, in my opinion. I just think it's a tragedy. Renee in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Renee, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say this issue really hits home with me.
Which issue?
The lawyer talking about homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was 16, my parents locked me in the basement because I was dating a girl, and it was very hard for me. I ran away and actually was taken to Children's Services, and Children's Services actually said that there was nothing they could do about it as long as my parents were feeding me and letting me shower, and was taken back home and locked in the basement again. And,
wow.
You know, it's just very hard because my parents were Christians. I was homeschooled, and I just see these Christian people, you know, allowing people to suffer, allowing people to be hurt, and calling it Christianity. And it's just so painful to see that. And, you know, I ended up living on my own for, you know, since I was 16. I moved out of my parents' house and really took care of myself. And I see kids all over suffering. I had one kid
Renee, I'm sorry we're out of time for the anecdote, but a good thank you for sharing your story with us. And I agree. Not only do we need civil rights, not only do we need hate crime legislation to include gays and lesbians, but we also need civil rights legislation to include, in my opinion. I mean, we're all members of the human family here. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain, on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And welcome back, my friends. Lawrence O'Donnell is with us. He was the... Wow, what a CV here. You blog over at Huffington Post, Lawrence. The political analyst to the Democratic Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance from 93 to 95. In 92, Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And recently made yourself a key figure in the coverage of the Valerie Plame scandal by naming Karl Rove as the primary source for Matt Cooper's story. Interesting. There's a lot more that you've done, though. Lawrence, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom. It's a rainy day in Los Angeles, and I don't know if that's an omen, but when Barack Obama arrived here the other day, it was probably the most beautiful day of the year. And so here's Hillary Clinton's day of arrival, and the rains come.
And this is why I wanted to have you on, Lawrence, because one of the things that I don't do well, and you do well, is looking at the political landscape and analyzing and understanding, for that matter, you know, how all the jockeying for position is going on, and how people are positioning themselves relative to each other, and what's likely or unlikely to succeed. What's your take on what's happening right now in the whole Democratic primary race?
Well, I do think this is one of the years when the front runners are real and powerful and have a tremendous advantage. McCain on the Republican side and Hillary and Obama on the Democratic side. On the Democratic side, though, there are some interesting players. Joe Biden has staked out the territory of the serious man. He's the one who sounds like the real adult in the Iraq discussion. And by the way, that's both a positive and a negative, you know, because he's the one who, after Dennis Kucinich or somebody says, let's get the troops out right now, Biden's the one who says, okay, then what happens?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's that adult question.
But his then what happens has, for, if my recollection is correct, over a year now been, let's go back to looking at these three states that used to be three states in the Ottoman Empire prior to the merging of them after World War I by Great Britain, and essentially redivide. Let's Balkanize the region.
Yeah, I actually just heard him speak this morning in Los Angeles, and so I'm very familiar with the Biden position, having just come from one of those Biden speeches.
Am I accurately characterizing it?
Yeah, absolutely, Tommy. He points out something that a lot of us miss, and I have to say I didn't realize it until he pointed it out this morning, and that is that in the Iraqi Constitution, it specifies a federated government, a federal form of government, and he, of course, argues, like Peter Galbraith does, for that three state, and I mean state like United States, three state version, one for Sunni, one for Shia, one for the Kurds, and he points out all the specifically designed weaknesses of the Baghdad government. For example, the Baghdad government doesn't even have the ability to tax. It does not have that power in the Constitution. And so what was anticipated all along in that Constitution is that you would have a strong, federated, three-state country there. And he's just an advocate of, let's get with that. Let's do that now.
Could it be that the reason that the right to tax or the power to tax is not in the Constitution is not so much that the drafters of the Constitution were expecting each one of these three states to have those powers independent, but rather that In large part, this constitution was drafted by Bremer and his buddies, and they were trying to create a neocon paradise over there to prove that George Marshall and Harry Truman were wrong with the Marshall Plan when they encouraged Japan and Germany to have national health care and strong protections for unions and strong social security programs and things like that, and frankly, protectionism, you know, the things like tariffs and things to protect their industries. And so they wanted to create this neoconservative paradise with a flat 15% income tax and doing away, you know, barring labor unions and throwing open the borders to anybody. I mean, that, it seems to me like that's as much a piece of it as anything else.
I think there could be a lot of that spirit in it. The other element of it, Tom, is the fear of dictatorship. And so when Bremer and these guys are sitting down to help design or design a government for Iraq, fear of dictatorship is high in their minds. And so they've ended up designing a weak central government, which is performing weakly, and that shouldn't really surprise anybody.
Sure.
It's in the design.
They didn't want another Saddam.
Exactly. And now, who knows what we're headed for? Who knows, in Biden's terms, what is the what next? Because clearly we're going to have to endure the Bush chapter of this. Bush is going to get to define what his chapter is, for the next 2 years. And then we're going to have, most likely, I think, a Democratic president take over, and it's going to be a different situation, which will basically involve some form of withdrawal at some speed or with all deliberate speed or possibly slower. But the ultimate question becomes, what next? What after all of that? Once the Democrats have been heard and we've done the withdrawal to whatever extent we do it, what happens next? And Biden, again, I don't mean to harp on him. I literally just came from a Biden speech here in L.A. Biden points out that everybody in the Democratic field agrees, even the ones who say get out now, the Edwards sort of position, that the get out now position would include leaving 30,000 troops there. So it isn't get out like Vietnam, you know, really
right.
Get out, and there will be
right.
A final help.
It's more like get out after Germany or after Japan.
Exactly, yes, who knows for how long.
Yeah. Well, actually, we have military bases in what, 122 countries, as I recall.
That's right.
Last
time we are still on the Rhine, as they would say, in terms of Germany, and obviously in Japan.
Lots of other places. So Joe Biden's position is well staked out. We're hearing a lot about these battles between Hillary and Obama. John Edwards seems to have been lost a little bit, and yet he had come out early on as a significant front runner. I still think he's a great candidate. What's happening with his candidacy relative to Hillary and Obama? Is he going to regain some press momentum, or are they going to continue? You know, is the press so in love with the idea of a black guy and a woman running for president that the white guy is going to get ignored? Is that an element? Am I handicapping that wrong?
Absolutely. That's basically it. I think the toughest thing strategically right now is trying to figure out how to keep John Edwards afloat. The problem for him is that he has a high expectation, and one of the other problems is that he did poll so high earlier on. Guys like Biden and Dodd, no one's expecting anything from them. So if Biden starts to get some traction, and if Biden, just to pick one of them, you know, starts to move up into, you know, 12, 13, 14% of the vote, that's going to start to play much more significant than Edwards being at, say, 18% of the vote in the polling. So Edwards has expectations to live up to, which are becoming increasingly difficult in what is this rock star campaign, Obama, you know, against Hillary. That is just, that's going to overwhelm the press. Nobody in the press, no one in the press corps wants to be on the John Edwards plane. Nobody. That's the third string press corps. Everybody wants to be on the Hillary plane or the Obama plane.
But this is another sign of this star obsessed media that we have, where it's all about celebrity and it's not about the issues. And there are real issues facing this country. And John Edwards has some very, very strong positions on many of those issues that actually differ from either Obama or Hillary's positions. And you know, how can we, or is it even possible? I consider it desirable. I mean, you feel free to challenge me on this. How can we get the press talking about the issues rather than, you know, gender, skin color, or personality?
All the press cares about is standing in the polls, which tends
But the standing in the polls is a function of the press to
That's
a large
right.
extent.
And and a function of celebrity. And so that's why they want to be on Obama and Hillary's plane, is because they, these two look like the possible winners. And, you know, as does McCain on the other side. And so
I think he's melting down.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Republican side, I think, is in tremendous trouble. They don't have any good choice on the Republican side. If there ever was an election that is structured in favor of the Democrats, this is it, with both weakness of support for the Republican candidates and actually the strength of the Democratic candidates. I mean, it is really a very impressive field. I mean, it doesn't have there isn't an Al Sharpton up there. There isn't the kind of ridiculous character on the stage. You know, Chris Dodd knows more about foreign policy than you could ever expect presidential candidates to realistically know. So does Biden.
It's a great field of candidates on the Democratic side.
Yeah,
it's an
interesting problem. Which is the better problem, having really a group of really strong candidates, or the Republican problem of having, you know, not sure which one to go with?
Yeah, well, I prefer the Democratic problem.
Yeah, Democrats have the better problem.
There you go. Lawrence O'Donnell, great talking with you, Lawrence.
Pleasure, Tom.
Thanks for being on the program. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Listen to that Bush administration. Welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. Well, Dick Cheney, I shared with you earlier Cheney's statement where he said basically that the Speaker Pelosi and Congressman Murtha are suggesting all we do is validate the Al-Qaeda strategy. Well, let's see. The Al-Qaeda strategy, as I recall, was make an attack on the United States and see if you can goad George Bush into creating such a military mess in the Middle East that the United States will get tied down and bogged down the same way the Soviet Union did in Afghanistan, and you can take down the United States, or at least harm it seriously, because Osama bin Laden was seriously upset with us over the fact that, A, we had infidels, American men and women who were driving cars and showing their elbows, and men who were drinking alcohol and probably had a copy of Hustler someplace on the holy soil of Saudi Arabia, and certainly had Christian Bibles, all things illegal in Saudi Arabia, and that these infidels were there because Bush Sr. put them there in 91 to stage for the attack of Kuwait, to drive Saddam out of Kuwait. And Osama bin Laden was pretty unambiguous. His two demands back in the late 90s, you know, were basically, I'm going to come and get you unless you, or if you don't, take the American troops out of Saudi Arabia, which I understand we've now done, Bush has done in the last year, number one. And number two, raise the price of oil, because you've got this corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia that is essentially giving away the wealth of the Holy Land to the infidels around the world, you know, for $15, $20 a barrel. Oil should be at least $100 a barrel. And so Osama bin Laden, it seems, has actually gotten everything he wanted. I mean, we have done exactly what he wanted. He wanted George Bush. The last thing that Osama bin Laden wanted George Bush to do is what Bill Clinton did the last time there was a terrorist incident in the United States in which hundreds of people died, which was when a religious extremist, believing that he was going to bring about a religious event, something like the return of Jesus or some variation on that, and that he was going to cause the American government to overreact, blew up the federal building. When Tim McVeigh had been reading the Turner Diaries, The Turner Diaries is this novel about how this good white Christian, white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, gun-toting guy blows up a federal building, and the federal government, the president, so overreacts by sending in the military and militarizing the United States and declaring martial law that all the good white gun-owning Protestants out there rise up and say, okay, that's it, we're taking the government back, and they kill all the Catholics, and they kill all the Jews, and they kill all the African-Americans, and they kill everybody of color, and all the only people left standing at the end of the book, the Turner Diaries, are the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant gun owners. And that's what Tim McVeigh thought would happen. He thought Bill Clinton was going to hyper-overreact and declare martial law and strip us of our civil liberties, and the Americans wouldn't stand for it, and they'd stand up and there'd be a revolution. He really thought he was bringing about a Christian revolution in the United States. So the last time we were attacked by a religious fanatic, what did Bill Clinton do? He said, this guy is a criminal. He has committed a crime. And we are going to track him down. We are going to put him in, we are going to give him his day in court, because we are a nation of laws. And if we find him guilty, he will be punished to whatever the extent of the law may be that is applicable. In McVeigh's case, it was death. And when that happened, when McVeigh was successfully prosecuted, the victims of Oklahoma City, of that bombing, had closure. They had an opportunity to say, the guy behind this has paid the price. And he didn't get what he wanted. He didn't get the loss of liberty in the United States. He didn't get the death and murder of minorities in the United States. He didn't accomplish anything that he wanted. So Osama bin Laden strikes us, you know, presumably. Hits us in 9/11. And the thing he is praying that Bush does not do is what Clinton did against Tim McVeigh. He is hoping against hope that Bush will not engage the Taliban and deport him to a foreign country where he could be held for trial and prosecuted for mass murder. He is hoping against hope that he will not be identified as a criminal. Because all across the Middle East, on the day after 9/11, you had candlelight vigils in Tehran on behalf of America. You had the French newspaper, Le Monde, we are all Americans now. And the Taliban said to the Bush administration, if you have any evidence that Osama bin Laden is behind this, we will arrest him today and hand him over to a neutral third country where a trial can be held. For example, the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Or perhaps it was that they wanted it to be a Middle Eastern country. But, that, you know, we'll hand him over for a trial. And Bush said no. No, we want to have a war, which is exactly what bin Laden wanted. He wanted those bombs. He wanted civilians to die. He wanted America to have that horrible black eye. He wanted us to do in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, exactly what the Russians had did in Afghanistan. And Bush walked right into his trap. And Cheney? Oh, man, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Kevin in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I have a suggestion for battling against the neocons and Bush's agenda, besides impeachment. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of these people got started with Nixon and I'd like to see them follow that. I don't think it's very effective. I think there's a torch that can be passed through impeachment. I would like to see indictments, and I think a good place to start would be for the state of New York to open up indictments for the The destruction of the 9/11 crime scene.
For criminal after 9/11 for the destruction
after 9/11
destruction of evidence.
Yeah, destruction of
evidence. Yeah, that's a good one. I also, you know, what about criminal negligence? You know, letting the thing happen.
Sure.
I mean, you know, well, 56 different specific warnings. You know, Mr. Bush, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. Oh, that's nice. Go back to Washington, D.C. I've got brush to cut. I mean, it's interesting one. Where's Elliot Spitzer when you need him, right?
Right. If we could open up some investigation into 9/11 and address, like, the molten metal in the basement? I mean, Jet Fuel doesn't do that.
Wasn't there supposed to be a couple of hundred tons of gold down there?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, and the steel got shipped to, like, China or something for recycling. Yeah, good point, Kevin, good point. Interesting. Yeah, there is so much. Yeah, I mean, we want to start a list of a bill of attainder, you know, a list of things that this administration could be indicted for. It's huge. Ken in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Tom, how you doing? Hey, a little while earlier, you had a guy on the phone you were interviewing who was arguing that homosexuality shouldn't be protected by hate crime laws because homosexuality is a choice. And I don't see why that's relevant. I mean, isn't religion a choice? Isn't Judaism a choice? And that's protected by hate crime legislation. So I just think there's a lot of distractions. You know, when you talk about, well, what does the Bible say, or is it a choice or not, it's totally irrelevant. The only thing that matters is what does the Constitution say. And anyway, you're always so logical. I was surprised that you got pulled into that because it really just doesn't have any bearing on.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, first of all, the Constitution doesn't talk about people making choices and doesn't, you know, and in fact, the Constitution, I don't think, talks about protected groups. There's an idea of equality, but we have decided over the years, because of the failures in the early years of this country, to protect the people who were formerly slaves in this country, and to protect women, and to protect other minorities. We have decided that to remedy some of the current ills in our society, that there are groups that are in need of protection. Frankly, hopefully over the short term. I mean, hopefully eventually we'll have a society where we don't need those kinds of protections, but what we do right now. And most of those are things that frankly are not choices. And whether you're born with your skin dark or not, whether you're born female or not, being the primary ones. I'm not completely buying it, Ken. I think it's an important distinction to make that being gay, by and large, is not a choice, and that this is part of the human family, and that if we are going to extend human rights, civil rights, to people who have been traditionally excluded from having those civil rights because of something that was not within their control, that we need to continue to extend, we need to extend those to gay people as well. And with regard to Judaism, I mean, for the people who hate Jews, you could have somebody who's born into a Jewish family with a Jewish-sounding name who could go out and convert to Catholicism next week, and the people who hate Jews are still going to go after that person. I mean, you saw that happen in Germany. So, you know, anti-Semitism is pretty mindless. So, you know, I still think that it's, you know, I'm not there with you.
Well, I'm just saying, I just think it's protected the same way that it's protected, that homosexuality should be protected the same way that Judaism would be protected, and the choice is irrelevant.
Well, yeah, okay. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree. But I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Walt in Los Angeles. Hey, Walt, what's up?
Hi, Tom, I want to congratulate you on the nice write-up you got in the L.A. Times a few days ago.
Well, thank you.
Wanted to tell you that
And thanks to the L.A. Times.
Yeah. Yes. I wanted to say that I think people like Lawrence O'Donnell have it completely wrong. And I can tell you that the scuttlebutt where I am amongst Democratic activists and people that go back to the 2000 campaign and 2004 campaign is that both Hillary and Obama can't win against a Republican. And they are looking for a candidate that can win. And all you have to do is look at the last election in 2006 with candidates like Jim Webb and John Tester. They are not going to want to have Hillary Clinton around their neck coming into their states. And the interesting thing is that states like Montana and Colorado and Arizona and Nevada, Virginia, they're ripe, you know, to be blue.
Right, and the progressive, the most progressive candidates are the ones who were winning in the biggest ways, and it's something that the DLC wing of the Democratic Party was going out of its way to minimize and not talk about, and the talking heads on TV, by and large, were going out of their way not to talk about. But you're right, the Tester in particular, or if you look in Brian Schweitzer in Montana, here's
right.
a guy, you know, probably one of the most progressive governors in the United States,
and one of
the reddest states in the United States, overwhelmingly elected.
I think guys like O'Donnell and Carville and McAuliffe are trying to create an aura of inevitability for Hillary, and Republicans are loving it. And going back to...
Well, I don't think that they're specifically trying to do that. I think what Lawrence O'Donnell was doing was accurately describing what's going on with our media, which is that they're more interested in celebrity than they are issues, and I think that that's a tragedy, frankly.
Well, the rank and file, when you talk to them, and I'm talking about people that are, you know, span the whole gamut of the Democratic Party, they like Obama, they don't like Hillary, but they also know Obama can't win. If Obama goes into rural Missouri and puts on a hat, he's going to look like Dukakis in a tank. And
well, I'm not sure that's true.
Well, you know,
I mean, we'll find out. That's what the primaries are all about.
Well, the primaries, that's the problem. You can win the primary and lose the general. And, you know, I'd love to see Dennis Kucinich in the White House, but he's not going to be there.
Yeah.
So you have to go with the viable candidate, and the viable candidate is Edwards.
Yeah, well, in my opinion, I mean, Edwards is the guy that I would be most in favor of, but, you know, as I've said a million times on this program, in my mind, it's all about the parade. I mean, whatever candidate we end up with, I'm going to support, and I'm going to work as hard as I can to push that candidate in the direction that I think is best for the United States, and you know, and hopefully that you do, and if not, you know, challenge me on it. But that's what we have to do, is we have to get the parade going. But
you know, I give Edwards a lot of credit for going into Connecticut and campaigning for Ned Lamont when a lot of other Democrats wouldn't do that.
Absolutely.
And also in L.A., he walked the picket line for the hotel workers, and he's been active in the Katrina thing.
Yeah,
whereas Hillary and Obama are in this celebrity sandbox fight, and who's getting the most money from Hollywood, the rank-and-file Democrats want a winner, and they don't see either one of those two as a winner.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thanks a lot for your comments. I don't disagree. Mark in Joplin, Missouri. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, just an update on the posse comitatus, and I'm not sure if this is directly tied, but it seems like Missouri is getting prepared, and Missouri's governor is Roy Blunt's son, and it's Republican House and Senate. But there's a House bill in Missouri, House Bill 619, that discusses the Civil Air Patrol, and specifically stating that if the mission of the patrol is granted a federal status, then the federal government will pay for the patrol and the services and equipment, and that the patrol personnel of the Civil Air Patrol, the Missouri Wing, will be declared and considered federal employees for the purpose of tort claims arising from whatever federal mission.
In other words, they're viewing a certain inevitability to George Bush federalizing the state militias, and they just want to make sure that it doesn't cost them any money when it happens.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Thank you.
And this is Republican legislators who are pushing this.
Yes, House and Senate both, and then, like I said, Roy Blunt's son is the governor of Missouri. So I just wonder if they got an inside track on Bush's, you know, and of course, Leahy and Bond. Now, Bond, our senator, is with Leahy, you know, fighting.
Republican, and he's taking a very good position on it. Mark, thanks for the heads up on that. That's fascinating. Matt in Oakland, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today? Matt? No, Matt. Okay. Let's go to Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to ask, is impeachment our only option to get a president out of office? What if there's an emergency and we need to get them out? Like, he's doing the exact same thing to the lead up to Iraq with Iran.
Yeah, the problem, there's, you know, the 25th Amendment provides for removing a president if he's incapacitated. But it's a long, drawn-out process. It's actually a relatively quick process, but it's rather drawn out. It's rather complex, and it, for all practical purposes, has to be initiated by the vice president. Not going to happen.
Oh, that's for sure.
The Constitution provides for removing a president, and it's called impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors. Those are the only two ways that a president can be removed from office. Now, what has happened, if you look at history, the only president who has really been removed from office, you know, outside of dying in office, is Nixon. And he was not impeached. He resigned.
Right.
He resigned because he knew he was facing impeachment, and he knew he was facing impeachment because he knew that high crimes and misdemeanors that he had personally committed and helped to cover up were being revealed in the House and the Senate, and there was no way he was going to get out of it. He knew that in all probability he was going to be impeached in the House and convicted in the Senate, or even if he wasn't going to be convicted in the Senate, he was already convicted in the court of public opinion, and he did the good and honorable thing, actually, to give Nixon a little bit of credit and said, okay, I'm leaving. Now, the dishonorable part about it, frankly, in my opinion, was when Jerry Ford then came in and said, okay, we'll set a precedent of pardoning him. And so the American people didn't have closure, and Bush is figuring, well, whatever I do, next, you know, on the way out, I'll pardon everybody. And that's the tragedy. But the impeachment is it, Amy. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome to the vast liberal conspiracy. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270. Still learning the new number here. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to, you were talking about Osama bin Laden and his motives and what he had written down and that he wanted us out of Saudi Arabia, et cetera. But the, another thing that people, I don't think very many people remember, is the fact that the Russians had many consultants in Iraq just prior to our invasion, and they were advising the Iraqi army on how to fight a guerrilla war that has since happened specifically the way.
Yeah, although they didn't need a lot of advice on it. I mean, they've been fighting guerrilla wars in that part of the world for 2,000 years.
That's true. Now, the other thing is, though, that since going back to Reagan and how he's been lauded as a great hero for defeating the Soviet Union, if you take a look at what's happened since the supposed Soviet Union has collapsed, we become more like them than they become like us. If you look at what Putin is now accusing us of.
Yep.
And also, just recently, my wife is from Russia. I don't know if you're familiar with a place called the Kamchatka Peninsula. For 50 years, that peninsula was totally isolated. Not even Russians could get in there without a special visa.
Yeah, when I used to work in Kaliningrad, which was the same thing. It was one of those top security areas.
And they have just within the last few weeks done that again. They have
interesting.
They and which all of the number one sub base is there. Their radar is there, and their ICBMs are there.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Well, and Putin has been essentially threatening us. And it's been like these little 3-inch stories in the paper where he's been saying, if you guys do this deal with Poland and put in your anti-ballistic missiles there that have the possibility of reaching Russia, or if you do this anti-missile system, the Star Wars system, and you cite it in Czechoslovakia, I am going to respond.
The thing is, Tom, what has happened since 9/11 has played right into Putin, who is an ex-KGB agent.
Sure.
I mean, the same people played right into their hands.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, John. And when Putin says to us, and as he did just a week or so ago, not only will we respond, but the response will be disproportionate. We should be very concerned. This is a guy who's sitting on 10,000 nuclear missiles that are still pointed at high alert at the United States.
They have played since the end of the Cold War, Tom. I believe this. I talked to many Russians. They have played possum. They took our money. They used our technology, and they have created a situation. The same people are in power.
Yeah, it's the old oligarchs are the new oligarchs in many ways. John, thanks for the call. Good point, well made. Rudy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Rudy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good to listen to you.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm just concerned about the lack of airwave, manipulation of the airwaves for the right wing. You know,
I'm not convinced that it's so much manipulation. I think it's, you know, I've been in this business a long time. I mean, I started as a DJ in 1968 as a teenager, and did news for 7 years. I was a program director for a while, and then I got out of the business in 78 and then started this show 4 years ago. And so I've seen the business from inside and from outside. And I think what happened was that when the Fairness Doctrine went away in 86, Limbaugh came on in 87, and he's a talented guy, and he did good radio, and eventually he got an audience. It took him about 2 years to do it. You know, about a year and a half in, he was begging people to call the advertisers and call the radio stations that there was a big liberal conspiracy to take him down. But anyhow, what happened was, because of the success of conservative talk radio, these guys promulgated this myth that conservative talk radio was the only kind of talk, was talk radio. And for a long time, because of a herd mentality in this radio industry, and ask anybody in the business, you know, it's there. Whether it's, you know, hey, let's do Drake format top 40 programming back in the late 60s, which is, you know, what I did in the mornings, or what, you know, whatever the fad du jour is. Hey, it's Charlie. That's it. Oh, let's do Jack. Things like that. There's a herd mentality in this industry. And so for a lot of years, people just figured, yeah, conservative talk radio, that's where you make your money. The people don't want to take chances. And I think now that progressive talk radio is proving that it can be successful and profitable, and we are successful and profitable in many markets. And the two things that are always consistent in those markets where it's successful and profitable is that the stations are being run by people who image them well, who, in other words, who make the entire station sound consistent, and there's a consistent sound so the listener can tune into pretty much any day part and know, ah, that's my station. Number one. And number two, they dedicate a sales force. They don't get the old guys who've been selling Rush Limbaugh for the last 15 years and know all the conservative power brokers in town. They get a dedicated sales force who cares about progressive politics to sell progressive radio. And when they do that, it works. So, Rudy, you know, I get your point, and I know that, you know, we're like, you know, 20 to 1 or 50 to 1 or something like that, outnumbered here on the progressive side. But trust me, we're on the incline. Even though some stations have fallen off, we are on the incline. It's going to get better. I'm absolutely, absolutely positive about that. I'm seeing it happen. Shelley, Detroit, Michigan, we just have a few seconds left. Shelley, what's up?
Okay, Tom, I had something else I wanted to talk to you, but I just want to say this. I am a hippie, and I am so frustrated right now with all of this running for president in February, with the war still going on.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about advertisers, and I think that this is all just one big machine. Why are we feeding it? And what can we do? Do we just wait for Gore to announce and then get behind him? Or
What can the old hippies do? Is that the question?
Old hippies, but we look really good.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, let me raise my hand. Shelley, no, I think that we need to get involved at the grassroots level. I would say show up for the local Democratic Party meeting, show up for the local Green Party meeting, show up for the local Republican Party meeting if you're inclined. You know, some folks are, you know, and get involved. And we, you know, we have to take this country back, and it's not going to be taken back by simply voting. It takes a lot more than that. Coming up on tomorrow's program, top news of the day, plus Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. He'll be taking your calls as he has for the last 3 years on this program. First hour of every Friday at noon Eastern Time. Conservative Tim Graham is here. We're going to be having a good food fight. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're in. See you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.